Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a tax refund in the fall. It could be coming from North Carolina. We'll tell you more. The legislature votes to force sheriffs to cooperate with ICE. The governor says no and vetoes the bill. Budget delays put teacher pay raises in limbo as school prepares to start. And CMS is in hot water over alleged molestation and complaints from parents about unequal treatment of kids with disabilities. All that and early voting is underway in the 9th Congressional District, as well as local races. A pedestrian bridge given the go-ahead, and NCDOT puts the brakes on numerous Charlotte road projects. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and they include Ann Doss Helms, education reporter here at WFAE News. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta is here. She's a reporter for Charlotte Agenda. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. And you brought family with you this morning. Your mother, your grandmother's here. Don't disgrace them. Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
And Jonathan Lowe is a reporter and anchor for Spectrum News. Hello to you.
Happy Friday, Mike.
Thank you. We're all on the radio and you can watch us on Facebook Live. So let's start with your money and the possibility that some may be coming back to you. Don't count on it. But as with everything these days, even that has disagreement attached to it, and that's why you shouldn't count on it. It appears that the state has a $900 million budget surplus, and General Assembly leaders believe that at least some of that money should be refunded to taxpayers this fall. House Speaker Tim Moore is among those trying to give roughly $680 million in tax refunds. That would be about $125 to single filers and $250 to people who file jointly as couples, just in time for Christmas around December 15th.
People sent more money than the government budgeted for, and the governor will not work with us to appropriate that surplus.
So what's the disagreement? Why is Governor Cooper against this?
I don't know that he's – go ahead, Katie, ladies first.
I was just going to say Cooper says that the state has other priorities, including more spending on education, water projects, the judicial system. Basically, we don't need to do anything else with this money except for use it on what we need to.
I know that Katie's probably smiling for the same reason that I am, that this is politics, and it's being held up. Yeah. This is the greater battle between the governor and the House Speaker and the Senate President over the budget. It involves teacher salaries, but the ultimatum is over Medicaid.
Yeah. So Senate Republican Leader Phil Berger says tax revenues do not belong to the government and should be returned to the people who earned it.
This cash is in the state's bank account, and it's time we gave it back to the people who earned it, the people who sent it to us.
So if the state collected more than they believe they would collect, but they claim not to be able to fund certain projects that are in the budget or that departments that need money and are being cut, why not use this money to do just that?
Well, they could do that, but as you know, it's always good politics to give money back to voters.
Just in time for Christmas.
Just in time for Christmas just before the start of or the real start of the next campaign season. What I would say, though, is that with the country showing serious signs of a possible recession, you would have to ask, is that really smart? A surplus today can turn into a deficit pretty quickly if we fall into recession.
Before the Great Recession, this state had a rainy day fund, if I'm not mistaken, and it kind of went dry during the Great Recession. Do we have one now? Could it use an influx of cash? Could this money be put toward that? Yes, no, maybe.
I don't know.
You don't know. And nobody knows?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Barry Boardman, chief economist for the General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division, says that personal income tax payments were higher and refunds were lower than expected. Plus, sales taxes in May and June were more than $150 million more than they expected. Now, I can understand why you can't predict sales taxes. That's the whim of the buying public. But why can't you predict income taxes?
Correct. And how is
they come in throughout the year?
I would assume that comes from people moving here, maybe also more people doing work here. That is just my assumption.
And or changing jobs, you know, losing jobs, getting a better paying job.
It is just very perplexing that you could be that much off, $900 some million off in overcharging people.
So Senator Jay Chaudhuri, he's a Republican, a Raleigh Democrat. He emailed the News and Observer up there, quote, Republican leadership is fooling themselves if they believe a little more than a one-time $100 tax refund will help North Carolina middle-class families. Here's what our middle-class families really need. They need us to invest those dollars in high-quality and well-paid teachers, better and affordable health care, and clean water and clean air. Of course, as you mentioned, Jonathan, Republicans have been holding back on the Medicaid expansion issue because they say we can't afford it. Would $900 million make a dent?
I would say probably not. I mean, there are a whole lot of infrastructure issues across the state. The NCTOT, with all of the storms we had and hurricane impacts we had last year, you know, there are just so many infrastructure issues that I don't even know that it would make a dent. But to your point about how this is playing out politically, you know, yes, the last thing we saw yesterday was, you know, this, like I said, all relates back to the budget and the impasse over the stalemate over the budget that is, I think, 42 days in. What the governor said yesterday, or what the question is now, are we going to see this budget broken down into smaller pieces? And could he then veto?
Yeah.
He's going to look at each bill specifically. And, you know, now how much longer does that protract itself?
Because that has become the plan. There's this immovable thing called the legislature and the governor and their loggerheads. And the governor is not going to sign the budget, and they don't have a supermajority to override it, and they don't want to compromise on Medicaid. So they want to break the budget down now into individual bills and pass them one by one by one. What's the likelihood of that actually happening?
Well, the governor said he would. I mean, he said in a statement to that. I mean, they keep going back and forth on this. He said yesterday that, you know, he'll just have to look at each one and judge them separately.
And typically, what you get is the opposite. You get a budget that finally passes, and it just has all sorts of stuff crammed into it. I'm not getting very good mic sound here.
No, you're not. No.
I'll pass to somebody else.
Just ignore that.
Okay. What you have is things that are not even related to the budget. Half the time, the education things that I see pop up in the budget bill that gets passed at the last minute.
Is it legal not to pass a budget and pass it piecemeal, bill by bill? Is that legal?
Well, I think that's why they've come up with this idea, because after so many days, it would... Federally, it causes shutdowns when we go so very long without a budget. So I would assume the same thing would happen on the state level.
I think that the thinking is that ultimately it will force Cooper's hand in some way or fashion. And ultimately, if he, you know, keeps vetoing the little chunks they send through, then they could kind of portray him as this politician who's against, you know, returning money to people. He's against, you know, like... I don't know what other objections they have.
And not just that, I think he would have a harder time sustaining vetoes against individual bills than he would against a budget as a whole.
Because then you're coming out for or against absolutely individual things.
Absolutely.
Correct. And Mike, it is important to note that the House Speaker said yesterday or day before yesterday that the Medicaid expansion is a non-starter.
Really?
So, non-starter.
And it's interesting when we're talking about big or small amounts of money that to remember that the Medicaid expansion, most of that is federal money that would come to North Carolina that we are not accepting, because there are some state costs attached to it. And there's always this sense that maybe at some point down the road, the state's share becomes a little larger. But we are actually, at this point, the state of North Carolina is saying no to a huge amount of federal money that would go to people who had received Medicaid expansion.
And just so people understand, you as a taxpayer in North Carolina are paying into that federal pot
exactly.
of money that we're not getting back because our legislature is saying no to that money coming back. At what point does that become politically untenable?
Not at this point, apparently. It's been going on for a few years.
I think unless the governor, I would assume, finds a way to make this relatable to people that don't understand Medicaid expansion, that... You know, the whole, like to what Katie just said, all these other things, if he starts saying no to these separate bills, you know, unless you find a way to sell this to other people, you know.
I think it was the Post the other day that did a story about how essentially other states without Medicaid expansion are paying into the pool for states that do receive it. So it was something along the lines of like North Carolinians are paying for Virginians to get Medicaid. Yeah. And Cooper had retweeted that. So I think that that message is something that they'll try to play up eventually because technically it's true.
Yeah.
So we have these major differences across the country between Republicans and Democrats, and North Carolina seems to be the epicenter of where this all comes together. Another area of disagreement in Raleigh between the governor and the Republican-led legislature is over immigration and over cooperating with ICE at the sheriff's department level around the states. North Carolina House members voted along party lines to pass a bill requiring sheriffs to comply with certain requests from ICE and federal immigration agents. The governor immediately vetoed the bill, calling it fear-mongering and unnecessary.
This legislation was passed only for partisan political purposes. As the former top law enforcement officer in this state, I know that we have the ability to prosecute and jail dangerous criminals regardless of immigration status.
Of course, the Republicans who passed the bill disagreed. Columbus County's Brendan Jones, the bill's sponsor, among them.
This was common sense legislation for the protection of the people of North Carolina. And I stand here with my fellow members in awe that this governor has chosen to side with illegal aliens, illegal criminals, over the citizens of North Carolina.
So there is some question about the constitutionality of statutorily requiring duly elected sheriffs to comply with a voluntary federal program at the risk of losing their jobs, because they could be removed under this law from office if they don't comply with a voluntary program. Is this something that will eventually run afoul of the Constitution if it somehow gets passed into law?
It's really hard to tell. I don't think it's going to be passed into law. I think
the governor's
veto will be upheld. There were opportunities for both sides to work together on this. This should not have been an either or. The governor's right. There are ways to keep dangerous criminals in jail short of honoring these detainers, but the two sides just seem to be at odds and just not willing to work on it.
Well, you know, I talked to the sheriff yesterday, and for him, this all comes down to the federal government not doing something that the federal government, it's the federal government's job. And he used the example of saying, you know, a person is here undocumented, they commit a crime, they are then deported, sent back. They come back illegally. That's considered illegal entry, that's a crime. He said, at that point, the federal government can and should put out a federal warrant for that person, but they don't.
Why not?
That's his question.
The Charlotte Observer asked that question of ICE, and they, for whatever reason, did not answer. If you are deported and you come back, not only is it a crime, it's a felony.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can get a felony warrant, but for whatever reason, ICE chooses not to do that.
Well, more to talk about with regard to this ICE bill, immigration bill within the legislature. That and a lot of things to talk about in advance of the first day of school. CMS finds itself in more hot water. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Katie Peralta, who has been promoted as we've been talking to senior editor of Charlotte Agenda. Welcome to you, Glenn Berkins, editor, publisher, QCityMetro.com. Do you want to augment your resume in any way?
Okay. It's fine.
And Dus Helms, reporter for WFAE News, and Jonathan Lowe, reporter, anchor for Spectrum.
And does this mean Katie's older than me now?
Yeah.
I'm not a senior.
She tells you what to do now.
So we were talking before the break about the bill that has been passed by the legislature that would require sheriffs throughout North Carolina to cooperate with voluntary programs with ICE, immigration and naturalization, whatever they call it now. And the governor is going to veto this. The House version of this bill was drawn up in response to the state's urban county sheriffs in Mecklenburg and Durham and Wake and other counties refusing to participate in 287G, and also, and I think that's identifying people in jail who perhaps are not citizens and who are here without documentation. And in decrying the governor's actions, Senator Chuck Edwards of Henderson County, a Republican, specifically mentioned Mecklenburg County. Here we go again, the center of attention with the bad news from the legislature. He said, Governor Cooper is choosing to side with sheriffs like the Mecklenburg County Sheriff, who in June just ignored an ICE detainer request on a man in custody for rape and child sex offense charges and released this dangerous individual back into the community. Remind us, what's the story here? Is that true?
Yes.
It is true, but the man was let go because the sheriff says the man was let go. He had to honor the guy's bond. So somebody gave him bond. A magistrate, a judge gave him bond. The judge or the sheriff had to honor.
And this has come up before. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden and I think some of the other urban sheriffs who are refusing to comply with 287G says to comply in some cases would put them in violation of the law. In that case, he would be violating his legally procured bond.
Correct. And you have to, what people, there's a whole lot of misinformation out there on this whole thing, and it's just become so polarizing that I think people just don't really know the core issue. But one of the things that the examples that the sheriff gave was, you know, what they want us to do is basically send these people back, send undocumented immigrants who commit crimes, or anybody for that matter, back.
What's
he
wrong
said,
with
but
that?
Because you're not giving them their day in court, which means victims, witnesses don't get their chance to get justice. Instead of just, so you send someone who's committed a crime, you just want to send all of those people back. Instead of having
this
them
is
go
where
through
it really
the court,
this really gets confusing.
It does. If you've
been accused of a crime, you have a right to your day in court under the Constitution. But you're not a citizen; you're an undocumented person, and you've committed a crime. That's another crime by
Correct.
Being an undocumented citizen who's in the country either overstaying your visa or have crossed the border illegally. Is it better in these people's minds, in the undocumented people's minds, to risk a trial in court that may put them in jail, or just to be sent back home? Which is worse?
Well, and we're talking about people who we're saying who committed crimes, but these are people who have been accused of a crime.
Yes, but
and that poses exactly that thing that you're going to get a penalty one way or the other,
even if you are
as innocent as until proven guilty.
And if the crime you've been accused of, I'll just pick one out of the hat, is car theft.
Right.
Car theft. Okay, you're going to go to jail if you're convicted of that. Okay, if you're not. You don't have documentation. They now know you're here. You're going to be deported. Why waste?
And these are people who probably don't have the money to hire a lawyer, don't have a strong sense of empowerment in the system.
So why go to court? Why not? If you can't produce documentation that you're here legally, why just go through the process of being deported? I don't understand it.
And so, it's a good question, but I think what the sheriff is wanting is for ICE to say, you know, here, sign off, have a judge sign off on this warrant so that everything is legal and above board. He is of the mind that it's better to have an undocumented immigrant accused of a crime have their day in court.
There needs to be a better system.
This system
absolutely does not work.
Right.
And we probably don't want sheriffs who are, by nature, to some degree, political, making these decisions. Warrants and things of that nature and honoring those warrants should not be subjective, but it should come from a judge or a magistrate. not these individual county sheriffs.
And then you have Gary McFadden saying something else that I'm not completely sure that I understand. And he said that this vetoed bill, HB 370, that we're talking about, quote, usurps the power of every sheriff and local community to set their own policies. Okay. But isn't that the case with every federal and state law that contradicts a local municipality's law or rule? How is this different? We see this all the time in this eternal combat between Raleigh and Charlotte.
I think he may have been speaking more philosophically than legally.
Okay. Yeah, that this adds another layer of the state specifically saying you have however many dozens of rules to comply with, but this one, if you don't comply with this one, you can be removed from office. So then that does become, do they start micromanaging all of them?
Again, it's a voluntary program. It's not a rule. 287G, which is this has everything to do with, is a voluntary program.
And these sheriffs campaigned on this issue. So voters knew exactly what they were getting when they elected these sheriffs.
I asked him yesterday, I said, knowing now that he's gotten all these awful death threats and, you know, concerned about the safety for his family, does he regret, pulling Mecklenburg County? He's like, not 1 minute.
Okay. Moving on. All of this is going on against the backdrop of our being nearly 2 months into a new fiscal year without a budget being signed. That means that Charlotte Mecklenburg School employees, including teachers, and other state employees who were slated for raises in this budget, won't get them. So teachers are going back into the classroom without the raises that they may have been counting on. What has been the reaction of teachers and staff to this, Ann?
Well, I haven't talked to a lot of them yet, but I can't imagine that they're happy about it. There was so much attention to there are different raises in the state, but also Mecklenburg County commissioners approved $8 million to increase the local supplement, and the idea was that Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools teachers would be the best paid teachers in the state. So they might naturally be expecting to see a raise. And what the district is saying, and it does make sense, the local supplement is not just a flat dollar amount. If it was going from $3,000 to $4,000, you could just spread out the extra $1,000 and give it to everybody. But the local supplement is tied to where you are on the state pay scale. And because the state pay does not have a 2019-20 pay scale yet, they're saying, just hold on. Now,
Will it be retroactive?
I would think so, but the letter from the district didn't actually say that. It just kind of said, stay tuned and we'll tell you what's going to happen. So that was
kind of their approach
to
everything, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that just seemed to me like you would say, okay, you're not getting it now, but you'll get it, you know, you'll get this nice little lump sum in whenever.
So there are other consequences to the budget being held up to at the school level, and that is that they can't hire, I'm told, the extra social workers and counselors that they intended to hire in the aftermath of these school shootings. How many people is that? That they'll be short because they can't pay them, because they can't hire them, because the budget hasn't passed. Do you know?
I'm always reluctant to cite numbers with CMS because there are 19,000 people always in flux, but the specific social workers and counselors we're talking about, you know, a few dozen. It's not a huge number, but it's a really crucial number.
Yeah, because it would take the ratio of students to counselors from 3,000 to 1 down to 1,500 to 1, which is a step in the right direction, I suppose, but
it's still way short of the recommended ratios.
So once the budget compromise is reached, have they identified the people that they want to hire for these jobs? In other words, could they say, okay, they just passed the budget, you're in, start working tomorrow?
Yes, they are definitely working with that and have people in the pipeline. The challenge is that, you know, if you're saying, I really want to hire you, and then somebody else over here says, we got a job for you, start tomorrow. Yeah. You know, that may not happen.
They may not be there.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but these counselors and teachers, a lot of them were going to be going to some of the most challenged schools in the district.
Exactly.
So that people know kind of what, and to Ann's initial point about how much these teachers were possibly going to be looking at, it, from the county at least. I was looking back in my notes from when CMS initially proposed the budget that had the increase in it. They had broken it down, a teacher with 1, 5, and 25 years of experience. So I'll just use for 5 years of experience. They get an annual increase of $2,626. That would break down to a workday increase, if this were to go through with that county supplement, of $12.20 per workday. So to give people an idea of possibly how much they were looking for in an increase A teacher with 25 years of experience was looking at an increase, annual increase of just over $4,000. So that's, you know, pretty significant for, you know, tenured teachers. Yeah. Teachers have been teaching for two decades. Were, you know, probably expecting to get a nice increase.
So that trouble is as the result of the budget not passing. Now we have other troubles, and lots of them, that CMS is facing.
Absolutely.
We learned this week that a CMS Spanish language volunteer who was charged in 2018 with sexually assaulting a first grader and who former CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox had said was thoroughly vetted may not have been. Tell us more.
Well, this is a really convoluted situation. Even describing him, I think that the initial headline said a volunteer, but he's not like a guy who just comes in and reads to kids. He has a for-profit business. It's a Spanish language.
Play Spanish.
Right, after school summer programs, and was widely participated in, was, I think, widely viewed as valuable in a community like this where you have a growing Hispanic population and a need for other kids to become fluent in Spanish. And he apparently kind of started based on some of these emails, and we do need to say that, you know, this is one side, this is selective information.
These are allegations.
But he started in, principals started letting him on their campuses, and kind of by the time CMS became aware of him, he was already kind of established. And when they really became aware of him was when they got a complaint from Matthews Elementary School. And I have not
When did that happen?
That was in 2013. Right, so
how
6 years ago.
How long has he been involved in the schools?
Since the late 90s.
Okay.
And you could say, again, you know, looking at this in hindsight and knowing about these two, actually
so
two
So we'll stop right there. Hold on. 2013, they get a complaint.
Right.
And he's still teaching for six more years? He's still coming to after-school programs?
Apparently the complaint was not verified, or at least was not verified enough to press criminal charges, and that's... You know, again, knowing now what we know,
right,
that there have been now two incidents where they have pressed criminal charges, where right, he is being held in jail. At that time, you had the one instance that apparently was difficult to verify. And in the course of their reporting, they found out that he had some other criminal charges, but not sustained convictions
CMS,
on other issues.
CMS background investigation discovered at least two felony arrests, a criminal conviction that had been overturned on appeal, and two incidents in which this fellow, Ricardo Mata, was suspected of molesting young students, one at CMS, in his background. How long did they know all of this? When did this research, this investigation from CMS come out with all those details?
That was in 2013. And the resolution of that was that...
And he stayed?
He stayed. And he continued to have this sort of unusual treatment. You know, if Charlotte Talks were to decide it wanted to have a community conversation at a school, it could make that arrangement and pay a certain fee. He was in there working with very closely with students, and he wasn't paying. And it's not really clear that he and or I assume he had responsibility for vetting his employees, but the problem doesn't seem to have been his employees. Yeah. It appears to have been him.
All right, that would have been over like several superintendents, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
So he is in Mecklenburg County Jail. He's not guilty. He's only been accused. He's in Mecklenburg County Jail, scheduled to stand trial in January on multiple counts of felony, indecent liberties with a child, and statutory sex offense on a child by an adult. And he is also... wait for it, an undocumented immigrant. What has he had to say about all of this?
Well, he has not been available. I talked to his
guess not.
His public defender yesterday, and his public defender said it's just not appropriate to comment, and he's not representing him in the civil suit. I'm not sure.
How did an undocumented immigrant manage to insinuate himself into CMS? Don't they check for that either?
I think CMS...
the hell is going on over
again,
there?
His whole origins is something that I would not attempt to comment on, but CMS does not take a firm stand about immigration status. Their stand... now, employment, they probably do. He's not a CMS and has never been a CMS employee.
Yes, he's a volunteer, and their volunteers don't go through the same rigorous background checks and fingerprinting and all that that a teacher or...
why not?
...other person does. I just had this discussion yesterday.
And, you know, again,
I'm
going
to get
the
answer to that question.
And they kind of muffed it at the CMS back-to-school briefing. We asked Ernest Winston about anything that was being done to prevent this, and they said, well, we've had the safety task force. They've made recommendations. And I said, well, what are some of them that would pertain to this kind of situation? And he said, you know, we do background checks on volunteers and we're fingerprinting volunteers.
Is that new?
It would have been if it were true. But about 30 minutes later, a public information person came out and said, actually, we're not fingerprinting volunteers.
Why does the although he's only 2 weeks into the job, why does he not know that? Because he was there for 15 years prior to taking the superintendent's job.
Right. And you can play gotcha on people. You know, there are always going to be things overlooked, but they had to have known that would be the first question. And it literally was. He said, I'll take questions. And somebody who was not even me, that was the first question out of their mouth.
Could this be one reason that led to the rapid, mysterious, forced resignation of Clayton Wilcox?
It could be.
Now that things are starting to come out, I wonder.
Well, the simple answer is we don't know and we probably never will know. My gut tells me this was not
a
big thing.
I'm really tired of this. This really ticks me off. Don't we have a right to know? Personnel files be damned.
That's a great editorial thing. And unless we are going to court to try to force them to release his personnel files, and I think North Carolina's privacy laws are geared toward protecting privacy of information as opposed to access. In Florida, this would be a very different discussion.
Okay. And that's not all. There's more. That's not the only controversy at CMS. Parents of an 11-year-old say that their child now has trouble walking and suffers more seizures and asthma attacks because of a series of injuries she sustained at Blythe Elementary School in Huntersville. CMS is looking into what happened. What do we know? What is being alleged?
Well, I did not do that story, so I don't have great details on this case, which is very complicated, but it's a situation that I came across time after time, and the Observer's story correctly pointed out that this has been going on over, again, a series of superintendents.
Yeah, Clayton Wilcox, Ann Clark, Heath Morrison, this all happened during their tenures.
Right, and which I think that the one question is this what forced Clayton Wilcox out? You have to say this was not a problem he created. Right. It was a problem he inherited and maybe did not handle well. As to whether kids are really getting what they need in classes for children with disabilities, that's a tough question.
I mean, this is serious because U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights in the Trump administration is investigating a dozen other cases in which CMS has been accused of violating the civil rights of students with disabilities or special needs. Why is this? We're just finding out about this now.
Well,
10 seconds.
They don't send out press releases on these things. You have to start doing a deep dive, and you get very limited information from them.
And Doss Helms from WFAE News, and we're here with Glenn Birkins, Jonathan Lowe, and Katie Peralta. We're coming right back with more. We'll be talking about a bunch of stuff, including early voting, which is underway. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. The political world has its attention elsewhere at the moment.
Hello, Iowa.
Thank you, New Hampshire.
But local offices with more of a day-to-day impact on Charlottesians are about to be on the ballot.
The Charlotte City Council meeting has now been called to order.
7 Democrats are running in next month's primary for City Council at large. Join Charlotte Talks for a live forum with the candidates Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. Registration and more details at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Andos Helms is here from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher at QCityMetro.com. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter and anchor for Spectrum News. And Katie Peralta is the senior editor of Charlotte Agenda. We're going to get to you, Katie. I promise you, we're going to get to you. We want to follow up just before we move and shift topics here to this fact that the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights is investigating at least a dozen cases at CMS. They've been accused of violating the civil rights of students with disabilities and special needs. And you have an interesting factoid to bring up about this.
Yeah, the context of that is that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools has 15,000 students who are classified as exceptional children or special needs. And that is more. There are only 25 school districts in North Carolina that have that many students, period. So it is a huge population, and that's the thing that's really difficult to tell, again, from the sparse information that tends to be available. And these include students with very complex needs. And so when I posted this story on social media, which was done by the Observers, Fred Kelly and Annie Ma, about half the people who responded said, about time. I've had this horrible experience. Somebody needs to expose CMS. And about half of them said, I feel really awful for this family, but I've gotten great services for my child with autism or with other disabilities. So it's really playing out at the school, you know, principal, teacher level. And I think it's hard to deduce from that how systemic this problem is.
After two controversies regarding CMS, you may think we're ready to move on. But wait, there's more. More controversy over the summer over a program called iStation. Is this an Apple program? It has an I in front of it.
That's what I thought.
It's not?
I think it's just become trendy.
Okay. Well, iStation is a program initially awarded an $8.3 million contract by North Carolina School Superintendent Mark Johnson to test reading skills for K through 3 students. What is this program? Why did state school leadership feel it was needed? And why is it controversial?
This all goes back to the Read to Achieve program, the idea that we really, really have to get third grader, get students reading on grade level by third grade, which everybody agrees with. You know, want to get up that level and everybody's happy. It starts getting to how do you test it and how do you measure it. And the old program that was used to collect data on that, which that data, by the way, was showing not much progress despite all the Read to Achieve efforts and millions of dollars being pumped in, that one was administered by teachers who would read to students and then evaluate them according to this software program, I guess it is. So they held a review group. The review group said, let's stick with this program. And Mark Johnson said no. And he has since said that he feels like there was a lot of impropriety and conflicts of interest among that panel. He said, no, we need to go with iStation, which is a more automated thing. The kids, very young children, are using a computer program that tests their skills. And some of the teachers and some of the people involved in this say, that's not as good. You're not going to get as good at data.
88 superintendents asked for a one-year delay in implementing iStation, but the State Board of Education denied that delay, and you tried to get an interview with Mark Johnson, I believe. What was the response?
It was we did not get an interview with him.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay.
But they did get a 6 months, I believe, a one-semester stay.
Leave.
Right, and CMS is using that. Some districts are not. Some districts are going to keep doing some form of this data collection. But CMS has said, you know what, we're still going to teach reading. We're still going to have teachers administering assessments that are part of the curriculum, but we're just not going to do this state logging in data for the first semester.
One more story about schools, and then we're moving on, baby. In 2017, school bonds approved $110 million to build a new high school in South Charlotte, and this week people lit up. Social media thinking that construction had begun. WSSC-TV spoke to a guy named Mike Wall. He's a resident of Old Providence neighborhood. He and others were surprised to hear bulldozers going to work, clearing trees in the woods behind their neighborhood.
What did I think? I was fuming mad. I hope they find something that they can't build here.
New CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston says, whoa, the Old Providence site is far from being a done deal to be home for this new school.
We're looking at all options, and so I just want to be very clear. It's an ongoing process, but we've begun some preliminary work.
So what does that mean? Do you bulldoze the woods to do preliminary work if you're not going to put the school there? What does that mean? Katie.
Tony Messia of the Charlotte Business Ledger has been digging into this and also over some of the controversy among neighbors in South Charlotte. And a few people he's talked to, I believe, had told him that Clayton Wilcox, the former superintendent, told neighbors at a neighborhood meeting or something that school overcrowding would result in a high school at Old Providence. This was a meeting back in the spring. So apparently this has been sort of something that's been the scuttlebutt for a while.
This new school would take kids from Ardrey Kell and South Meck, which are already at capacity, and put them into a new high school.
Right. And I think that the issue here is, well, first of all, there are very few parcels of land in South Charlotte large enough to accommodate a facility like this. I think the one at Old Providence is like 40 acres or something like that. So technically it could fit. The traffic would be all kinds of hell.
Is that why Mike Wall was hopping mad? He described himself as that.
Yeah. And Sean Strain, the school board member for that area, has kind of tried to throw the brakes on this. He says Clayton Wilcox had said, this is where we're going to do it. It's land that we own. It costs a lot of money to buy potentially a 50 or 60 acre site in booming Ballantyne, South Charlotte, so we're going to use our property. But with that change in superintendents, Sean Strain said, whoa, we need to come back and evaluate it. He says it's not big enough for a real high school with parking and athletic fields and all that, and that he thinks it's the wrong location.
Okay, and they are looking at other sites, but what explains the bulldozers?
soil testing?
That's what they were calling it. I think that they were moving ahead.
You can't do that with a teaspoon and a vial?
That's a good question.
I think soil testing might be a euphemism at this point.
Fair. Just take that with a grain of salt.
I know nothing about soil testing, quite clearly. Okay, Queen's University is following in the footsteps of some other institutions of higher education. They are eliminating the SAT and the ACT as requirements to consider you for admission. Why, Katie?
Queen says that this is a way to open up access to higher education, which...
Are they doing this for everybody?
Yeah, I think it starts in the fall of 2020 for new applicants, sort of as a way to open the doors a little bit. When you think of SAT prep classes, the SAT itself...
The college app, it's...
The college
fee.
App, exactly. It all adds up quite significantly. And if you don't like your score on the SAT, you can take it again.
Right.
You can hire a tutor. You can get, you know, all this stuff that really adds up. And so,
in fact, on Spectrum News yesterday, that's what I heard one of the people from Queen's University say, mm-hmm. that there are people out there who could come to this university, but they can't afford to take the test, particularly if they have to take them more than once. And so this removes that barrier to entry. We'd eliminate the need for the test.
Yeah, there's certainly an effort to promote diversity through this effort for people who can't afford all of that. Because there are high school students out there who can't, you know, afford
and
all those fees.
And there's long been a debate about whether those tests actually are predictors of academic success in college.
Yeah. And this will, you know, look at the holistic student.
I've never taken the LSAT, which is the law school entry exam, but Malcolm Gladwell, who does a wonderful podcast, did a whole series on the LSAT, and it demonstrates absolutely nothing about your success as a lawyer. Nothing. Zero. And he asks, why are these tests timed? Maybe you're a tortoise and not a hare, and if you had more time, you could do really well. And that's the same is true with the SAT. So if you don't use the SAT or the ACT, what do you use? How do you determine whether that person is ready for your school?
There's a whole basket of items you could look at. You could look at the curriculum in high school, you know, extracurricular activities, teacher recommendations.
I think they said, Katie, that the GPA is a better measure mm-hmm. than the ACT or SAT of how someone will do in college. Yeah. I do remember hearing that.
Exactly.
So early voting began this week in the 9th Congressional District elections, as well as some local primaries. What kind of turnout have we witnessed so far? Do we know?
I think on the first day there was like just over 300 people.
Is that good?
We heard from Michael Dickerson, the Board of Elections head, on percentage-wise, but considering the fact that the 9th district election is not the only thing, even though that's getting the most attention with this primary, you know, there are some important Charlotte races.
Are they getting
city
lost,
council.
Do you think? Do people know
I
that?
I don't think many people know that, not with only 300 people.
There are a lot of at-large candidates with opposition running in this primary.
Absolutely. Even the mayor.
The mayor has several, although it will be a miracle if she loses this primary.
Absolutely.
But will that hold back turnout where the 9th district is not?
I'm worried that it will.
I think Mecklenburg is so heavily Democratic that these primaries will decide ultimately who the winners are in the general election. So that's what people probably should realize. And quite honestly, these are the people making actual decisions that affect your everyday life. The federal elections are so much sexier and they're so much more fun to talk about. But I think for these, you know, these are the folks who are deciding whether to invite the RNC. They're talking about affordable housing. And so, With things like municipal primaries, the turnout is just not going to – what was it last time, like under 8% or something like that?
And as you say, Katie, with the Democrats having so much power in the city and the county, there's not a lot to debate. It's not like you're – you know, this Democrat is radically different politically from someone else. So.
Well, I will say that a number of the candidates that are running against the incumbents are millennials. There's a UNCC student. One of the mayoral candidates is a pretty young guy. So I think that this election has attracted a lot more millennials.
As luck would have it, we are holding a candidate forum on Wednesday evening here at Spirit Square in the McGlohan Theater next Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock with all of the Democratic at-large city council primary candidates. You can come to that, but you need to register first at WFAE.org. No admission charge. It's free. But we just want to know you're coming.
And there is a Republican running against the mayor. So okay. It's important.
Voting, as you say, the 9th District has a lot of interest in it because it's been going on for 2 years now. The only debate these two candidates, the two Dans, will engage in will be on WBTV August 28th, a week and a half after early voting begins. Is that unusual for a debate to be underway while voting is underway?
It seems odd.
It seems odd that they've not had one before then. Whether they have one during early voting is another issue, but you would think there would have been one before the voting.
There was supposed to be, Glenn, and there was a whole lot of back and forth between the campaigns on having one, two debates.
So that debate will be on opposite our candidate forum. Is that what I'm to understand?
Okay. Sounds like it.
Okay, so you don't need to watch that debate. Because you can learn everything you'll ever want to know from the candidate commercials. There's a ton of money pouring in here on these commercials. How much of what is being said on both sides is true?
Well, let's look at the ad that includes the sheriff. I don't know. That's a hard question.
All right. Let's move on.
Yeah.
The I-77 is going to get another bridge. I-277 is going to get another bridge. It's going to be a pedestrian bridge. The U.S. Bank kicked in some money, and so Charlotte Center City Partners said, we're ready to do this thing, right?
This is very unusual because you don't really see public-private partnerships on infrastructure in our area. So I guess the last piece of this puzzle that was missing was about $1 million from the private sector. There's money coming from NCDOT, the City of Charlotte, Mecklenburg County. U.S. Bank, which announced, I think, last year or earlier this year that they were expanding a retail presence in Charlotte with 10 branches, I think, by the end of 2020. This is them putting their stamp on something. This is them kind of, you know, this is their entrance into the Charlotte market, and they wanted their name on something that, you know, is pretty prominent. And Jonathan's shaking his head over there.
I'm a little bit of a cynic on it.
Well, there are a lot of infrastructure needs in our city, including a bridge over Independence. And that is something that has been talked about a lot. I think there are serious safety concerns.
A pedestrian bridge over Independence?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Since they're building the Hawthorne Street Bridge now for the second time, why don't they just put pedestrian and bicycle lanes on that bridge? Why didn't they? It's too late now.
Because that's closer to Uptown. The problem of people crossing Independence happens farther down.
Okay. So this will begin when? The construction will begin when? When will it be completed on this?
This is a very exciting story but it's going to be years until people can actually cross from the South End into Uptown.
Because this is the last leg. This closes the gap in the rail trail, and they were going to put that thing across the Blue Line Bridge, but during the recession hit, and they didn't have any money for this. But you mentioned, Katie, that NCDOT is kicking in funds for this, but they're also removing funds or delaying funds for a lot of, 48 projects in Mecklenburg and surrounding counties for budgetary reasons, despite this $900 million surplus. What's going to go by the wayside or be put on hold?
Well, don't forget, in addition to that, there are about 1,000 workers throughout the state who are losing jobs, at least temporarily, because of the shortfall.
And yes, the shortfall in funding for the NCDOT, and a lot of those jobs were filling potholes for damage done during hurricanes and floods, which need to be done, but you can't do them without the people to do them, and we have $900 million to put toward that. Why don't we?
And this is what we were talking about during the break. I'm not really sure why you can't just scoop out of this bucket and plop it into it.
Again, NCDOT, back to my point of Independence Boulevard, that's their road. Katie and I were talking about this. There are two other ways to get across from Uptown to South End. A pedestrian bridge, a third one.
We must leave you with another school thought. It starts Monday. Buses have been doing trial runs this week. Will CMS be ready?
I think they will. They're always ready to open schools. You know, no matter how much drama is going on in the political scene, yeah, the teachers are going to be there. They say they've done a pretty good job of filling their vacancies. I think we can hope for a smooth start.
Of course, well, except for traffic.
Traffic is going to be bad.
It's always horrible in the first week of school, and we're doing a program Monday on traffic for that very reason. Ann Doss Helms from WFAE, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Glenn Birkins from QCD Metro, Katie Peralta. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.